Do you hate God? I know, we're a title, but I promise it's not just clickbait. So stay with me here and stay tuned for this episode of the Crosswalk Podcast. We're back here with the Crosswalk Podcast, and by we, I mean me. Caleb is not here with me today, unfortunately, so it's kind of weird for me. I don't really like recording these by myself. I love the conversation aspect of it, but it'll be all right. So we've got a great one for you today. Man, it's a weird title, and shout out to Caleb and Carrie, right, because they just had a baby. Yeah, and so, you know, that's why Caleb's not here. He's at home being an awesome new dad, so many prayers. Say prayers for them, please, as they navigate those first few days and weeks of being parents. That's a tough one. But today, I kind of wanted to dive into something that keeps recurring for me in my personal Bible study, in my time with the Lord, and a lot of different things that come up lately. And so it's, I know, a very weird title. Do you hate God? And for our average listener, to our average viewers, the answer, of course, is going to be no in our typical sense of how we understand that word, right? Because a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are already believers. But if you happen to come across this and you're like, oh, yeah, maybe I do hate God in the sense of I really detest him. I don't like God. Maybe you are an atheist. Maybe you are of a different faith and you're like, no, I don't want anything to do with this idea of the Christian God or anything. I encourage you, stay tuned, stay listened. You're going to have something kind of interesting here. And so, if you are kind of one of our average listeners and you are a Christian, you're thinking, man, Chuck, you are off your rocker. You've lost it, man. What in the world are you talking about? So I want to keep today kind of short, but I also want to kind of try to keep it conversational. So I'm going to ask some questions along the way since I don't have Caleb here with me again. But, you know, I heard a sermon recently by a guy named Mark Clark. He's from Village Church up in Canada. I think from near Ontario, maybe. And really cool guy. I love listening to him, listening to his sermons. And he preached a sermon recently called The Problem of Loving God. It's in a series called The Problem of Jesus. And the sermon is all about loving God. And so, of course, in this sermon, this message that I heard, he brings up Luke 14:26. And so Luke 14:26, if you don't know right off the top of your head, I wouldn't if I hadn't studied for it. This is a passage where Jesus is speaking. And in Luke 14:26, Jesus says these words, and I want you to listen carefully. These are kind of weird. If anyone comes to me, as in Jesus, right? If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, and yes, again, the context is hating, right? And even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And so Jesus really he lays it on thick here. This is a tough thing to handle, a tough truth. And we kind of read this, and I read this, and I'm like, man, what in the world does Jesus mean here, right? Jesus doesn't teach us to hate people, does he? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So why say this? Well, when you read and you kind of get a little more context, if you back up literally just one verse and you kind of begin at kind of the beginning of this narrative here, he said, in Luke 14:25, he says, now, great crowds, Luke records this, and again, Luke was not necessarily an eyewitness to all these events, but he spoke to eyewitnesses. Luke sat down, and he tells us that he actually sat down to write an orderly account of all these events surrounding Jesus, and so he has gone to eyewitness sources and gotten information from them directly, okay? And we trust that. That's firsthand accounts. That's what we trust in when we're looking for good quality information. So Luke gives us this, and they say, now, great crowds were traveling with him. And in my mind, I'm thinking, like, in the context of ministry and stuff, I'm like, if we draw a huge crowd, like, that's cool. Like, that's a good thing. But when Jesus drew these great crowds that were traveling with him, it wasn't good enough for him, right? He didn't look and he didn't say, like, oh, we've got these big crowds. This is awesome. We're winning. We're succeeding. He actually turned. It says the great crowds were following him. So he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. In other words, Jesus is telling them, and I think he's telling you and me, to count the cost of discipleship. And this is something that Caleb and I have had so many conversations about, and I want to, again, try to keep it conversational. It's just hard when it's just me and a camera in a room. But, you know, we have talked about this, and we have said, you know, we really look around, and me and Caleb are just as guilty. We really look around, and we see a lot of cultural Christianity going on. We see a lot of easy discipleship. We see a lot of no strings attached discipleship going on. Things that really just don't have a majorly huge bearing on our lives. We look and we come to church and we do things, and maybe we do Bible study, maybe you lead ministries like I have, and you still, and you look and you're like, man, but how am I living the rest of the time? Like, how am I living day to day in the way that I talk to my wife? How am I living day to day in the way that I raise my kids? How am I living day to day in the way that I go to school, or the way that I work my job, or the way that I treat my siblings or my parents or whatever else? And Jesus is saying, listen, this is a big deal. Later, after he has died and he has risen from the dead, which, by the way, is the basis of our faith, right? I mean, like Caleb and I, we love talking about this. This is the basis of our faith. The basis of our faith, like what, like if there's one thing that that's the bedrock of it, that if you undid this, our entire faith would crumble, it's the resurrection of Jesus, right? We just celebrated that at Easter, right? And so the resurrection of Jesus, if there was no resurrection, well, there's no Christianity. Because that's the basis of Christianity. It's not a book. It's not a set of rules. It's not a set of do's and don'ts. It's an event. The basis of Christianity is an event. And from that event, then you look and you say, okay, the man who said he was God, who said he was God's own son, said he was going to die, be crucified, and rise again, and then pulled it off. That event that you can, we can show with great evidence from history that the resurrection actually occurred, that is what prompts me to believe everything that Jesus said. And so later, once he has risen from the dead, yes, he offers eternal life freely to people. But here's the thing. It comes, I don't want to say it, there's really are strings attached to it, in the sense of there are things that are going to change in your life if you are really becoming a disciple of Jesus. And I want us to be careful and look at that. Like in the New Testament, it doesn't talk about Christians except for a few times, like that word Christian, but the word disciple is used all over the place. All over the place. And a disciple is somebody who really presses in, they lean in, they truly follow it. What they are following and what they're buying into has an effect on their life. And I really fear that me at times, but many people, especially in the community where I live, that their Christianity doesn't really have a big effect on their life. They just live, they say, they do whatever they want, and it doesn't really impact them that much. That's just like, oh, I heard that, you know, I have sin in my life. Sin separates me from God for eternity. But if I'll believe in Jesus and believe that he died for me and that he rose again, and say a prayer confessing those things to God, then I'm good. I'll escape hell. And then I just do what I want. But that's not what Jesus taught. And so Jesus is talking about people following him. In this passage, in a literal sense, they're literally like following him around. And so he turns around after saying this, hey, if you don't hate. Now, does he mean hate here? No. It's a little bit of a hyperbole, right? But at the same time, the kind of root of the word that he used that gets translated hate, it means to kind of detest, but even more so kind of to love less. It's a comparison. It shows a comparison of two things. And so Jesus is saying, look, if you don't love me more, if you don't love me more than your own father and mother, if you don't love me more than your wife, or if you're a woman, your husband, and children, or your brothers and your sisters, yes, if you don't love me even more than your very own life, then you can't be my disciple. And then I compare that with the way that I live sometimes. And I compare that with the way that many people who claim to be Christians that I know, and I'm not saying they're not, I'm not throwing rocks at anybody or bashing anybody. I'm saying I compare that with the people who say they're Christians. And I don't know, is that really true? Is that really true that we love Jesus more than these people, more than our very own lives? So Jesus kind of goes on and gives them these really great illustrations that even we today can understand. In Luke 14, 28, he says, "For which of you wanting to build a tower doesn't first sit down?" So I imagine this literally like a sitting down, like we're going to do some accounting. We're going to get out the pen and paper, and or in that time period, I don't know what exactly they wrote with, but we're going to do some little scratch work. We're going to do some figuring in our head. And we're going to sit down, and we're going to count the cost. We're going to calculate the cost to build this tower, or to put it in modern terms, to build a house even. Right now is a great time if you want to sell your house and get top dollar. It's not a good time if you want to build a house. Materials are sky high, and so we have to sit down and calculate the cost to see if we have enough to complete it. Otherwise, after he's laid the foundation and cannot finish it, all the onlookers will begin to ridicule him, saying, "This man started to build and he couldn't finish it. You look a bit ridiculous here." I would look pretty ridiculous if I sold my current home that I own, if I sold my home to get the top dollar for it and then started to build and realized I picked the wrong time and didn't calculate the cost beforehand, and I really just got the foundation and realized I couldn't do anymore, and I wasn't going to go, couldn't go into that much debt for it, and I still have to look for another place to live. I'd look a bit ridiculous. I'd look foolish. What was he thinking when he did this? And Jesus gives us illustration. Or he puts it this way. He goes on in verse 31, Luke 14, "Or what king going to war against another king will not first sit down and decide if he's able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000. Again, so kind of modern, let's modernize this for just a moment here. How many of you have ever, you've been about to get in a fight and you look up and you're sizing the guy or the girl or whoever up and you're like, okay, yeah, I think I can take him, or no, maybe I can't. And so this king is doing the same thing, but with a whole army, right? And he's looking at him, he's sizing up the enemy, and he's like, okay, can we take them on? Yeah, they got 20,000, but are they 20,000 that we can handle with our 10,000? If not, while the other is still far off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. And so the question kind of is, like, when you're sizing that person up, looking at him like, okay, this could get physical here, maybe you're trying to avoid it, right? And you start talking, trying to bring peace to the situation. In the same way, therefore, every one of you who does not renounce all his possessions cannot be my disciple. He's saying you need to count the cost. And that is something that I don't always hear preached. That is something that I'm guilty of not always preaching, of not always saying to people who I'm trying to illuminate to the sin in their life. I'm trying to illuminate the gospel to them. I haven't completely always been 100% honest and been like, hey, you need to count the cost before you do this. You need to recognize that if you become a follower of Jesus, there are going to be changes that need to occur. Namely, okay, Jesus is putting it, again, a bit of a hyperbole to put it in context, but namely, you need to stop hating God. Let me put it to you that way. Let me employ Jesus' own tactic here. You need to stop hating God, because if you're loving other things and other people and other relationships and other pleasures and all these other stuff, if you're loving that more than you're loving God, by Jesus' logic here, by the hyperbole, the rhetorical thing that he's getting at here, you're guilty of hating God. Whew. And so when I was studying recently and looking at that, I was like, oh man, I'm guilty. And I've been praying, God, I don't want to hate you in this sense that Jesus used this, right? In the way that he used this phrase. Now, I'm not hating God in the sense of I'm angry at God, I curse God, that I purposely go out of my way to do bad, or I'm harboring harsh feelings for him. And that's not what Jesus told us to do when he says, hate your father and mother, brother, sister, wife, children, your very life. He's not saying have disdain for it. He's saying you need to love those things less than you love God. And I'm not saying this to put people down. You know what? I'm not bringing this up. This was, I mean, it's not exactly a great I guess it's eye-catching, but it's not exactly a feel-good title for a podcast. It's not exactly a feel-good conversation to have. But I want to bring attention to it because we tend to live our lives in rhythms that largely ignore God. Or we make him a small part of that rhythm. But Jesus here is saying, no, you need to be willing to renounce your possessions. In other words, you need to love me more than your stuff. You need to be willing to renounce your family. In other words, again, not be hateful or mean or never talk to them or never see them, but you need to be willing to love me more than your family. That's hard. Like, if God were to try to call me and my wife to something else, to somewhere else, could I even hear it right now? Like, could I take my kid? I got two kids, but only one of them's in school right now. Could I take my kid out of school that's in school? Could we sell our stuff, pack up, and move somewhere else? We got a lot of family here. My parents live here. My in-laws live here. I still have some grandparents that are here and everything. Could I take my family away from all of that if God told me to? Or would I ever even be able to hear that call because I'm loving those things more than him? It's a tough question to answer. It's a tough thing to deal with. But Jesus comes in, he says, no, I don't simply want to be one beat in this rhythm of your life. He says, I'm going to be the songwriter and the conductor controlling the rhythm and the tempo of your life. That is the cost of discipleship, that you fully surrender to him. That is his cost of discipleship. And so whether we are intentional with our rhythms or not, like we live our life by a certain rhythm. Again, whether it's by accident or whether it's intentional, there are rhythms to our lives, and those rhythms reveal our values. So if you were to follow me in any given week, my rhythms, you're going to realize that I value coffee, okay? I actually don't have any with me right now because I'm recording kind of later in the evening, but I like coffee, man. In the mornings, I value coffee, okay? That's my rhythm. I wake up in the morning and I drink coffee. You would also find that in the morning is when I tend to read scripture every day, every day. I value that. It's part of it. I've tried to build that into the rhythm of my life. But if I value relaxation and trying to unwind, then you're going to find that in the rhythm of my life. If my week were to include a lot of Netflix, then clearly I'm valuing entertainment. If I make time for exercise, I'm valuing my fitness. And the amount of time that I spend on these things that I value is only part of the equation. Because if I really, really value something, right? When we do this, like if we really, really value something, then we opt for quality time in it, not just a great quantity of time. And so let me give an example for myself. Man, like the Bible app, okay? So the YouVersion Bible app, I highly recommend that you download this app. It's free, wonderful. It's got many Bible translations on it, but a ton of different Bible studies. That's where the money is. It's got thousands and thousands of Bible study plans that you can follow. And there are times that I'm not always going for quality time in the scriptures. Sometimes I'm just going for quantity. I'm guilty of that, of sometimes valuing, keeping a routine of doing something more than I'm actually valuing the time with God that it's meant to be. You know, and how much love and adoration is that really showing to my Creator? To my Savior, to my Lord. Again, the one who's supposed to be the boss, the songwriter, right? The conductor of my life. And so, you know, what do we do? How do we do this? Because I didn't want to bring up the conversation and get us all thinking about this. Man, am I loving other things more than God without hopefully kind of bringing some solution to it? And so Jesus really brought this up. And he's like, hey, if you want to be my disciple, you have to be willing to love me more than anything, because that's ultimately for your benefit. Jesus is the highest. He is the ultimate of anything or anyone. And so it would only make sense that we would love the ultimate the most. And so if we're not loving him the most, it's actually not in our best interest, because that's what we were created for in the first place. It's our purpose. And so he kind of gives us, we can look back at another interaction that Jesus had with some people that again, if you're trying to build a ministry and build a following, Jesus didn't do a very good job. Because his interaction with these people, they, again, he kind of shuts them down. But he really puts us on point if we're going to be his disciples. And so, you know, if you look at Matthew chapter 22, is one of the places you can find this. It's also recorded in Mark's gospel and Luke's gospel. But in Matthew 22, starting in like the verse 34, there were some religious groups that they really wanted to be in charge. They wanted to be the people that all the common folk came to for their religious questions, for their questions about morality, their questions of the Jewish law and everything. And they wanted to maintain this status quo. And one of these groups was called the Sadducees. And there was another group called the Pharisees, and they really didn't get along. And so if you've been in church very long, or if you've ever been to Sunday school, or you've, you know, read the Bible, the New Testament much, you've heard of these names, right? You know about the Pharisees, you know about the Sadducees. They did not get along. They clashed all the time because the Sadducees didn't believe in any kind of resurrection from the dead. The Pharisees did. And so they had some disagreements over the law of Moses and these things and the prophets in the Old Testament. But Jesus was so scandalous, right? Jesus, just because he was right doesn't mean it didn't cause a scandal, didn't mean it didn't cause an uproar. Jesus was so scandalous to their culture and to their way of life and to their religious establishment that these two groups that really couldn't stand each other actually came together, right? So the enemy of my enemy is my friend, basically, in this case, right? So the enemy of Jesus, the Sadducees, they're now going to be friends because they and the Pharisees are starting to work together. And so in Matthew 22, when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced, he being Jesus, because, you know, man, they every time they tried to stump him, he would just absolutely just own them with his response. They heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, and so they came together. So now we got the Pharisees and the Sadducees working together, and one of them, an expert in the law, asked a question to test him. And so they're always trying to do this. They're always trying to trip him up on something he says so they can discredit him and get rid of him, and these people stop following him. And so he says, and so the expert in the law asked a question to test him. And this, you know, again, referencing that sermon that I heard by Mark Clark, you know, he was saying that experts tell us it actually wasn't uncommon back then for people to ask a teacher, which is what the guy refers to Jesus as. He says, teacher. It wasn't uncommon for them to ask these teachers, these rabbis, hey, what's your kind of bottom line? What's your lowest common denominator? What's your thing that you're all about? And so this question that he asked him, he says, teacher, which command is the greatest? It wouldn't have been an uncommon question, but they're trying to trip him up because a lot of times this is what people would do. Which command do they say is greatest? Well, you know, if they're not careful how they choose that, they're going to get themselves in a lot of trouble and they're going to lose their followers. And so Jesus says to him, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. He picked pretty well. He chose pretty well, right? He says, this is the greatest and most important command. And then he goes on, though. It's kind of funny here because, like, you know, the guy asked him which command is the greatest, right? And there was like 600, over 600, a little over 600 laws, commands, statutes, ordinances, things that they were supposed to follow in the Old Testament law of Moses that God gave to Moses, you know, at Mount Sinai. And he asked him which was the greatest, and he answered that, but then nobody else was even got like a word in before Jesus continues on. He says, the second is like it. And so it's almost like the way that he puts it here, it's almost like greatest command one and one A, right? It's like it's very much like it. Okay. It's like these are the two most important, in case you were wondering, Jesus is saying. The second's like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets. When they reference the law and the prophets, they're basically, that was what they called the scriptures. That was the Old Testament. They didn't call it the Old Testament. That was their only Bible, right? But that was the scriptures. The law and the prophets hang on these two commands, he says. He's like, everything rests on these. That you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. You know, elsewhere it says with all your strength. And then love your neighbor as yourself. So where did Jesus get this? I mean, other than the fact that, like, okay, so again, he's God. He claimed deity and he allowed people to worship him. He says, I and the Father are one. So he is God. And so therefore, he's more qualified than anybody to decide which of his commands is the greatest. But what made Jesus decide these two? Right? Where did these come from in the scriptures? Where are these commands recorded? Well, the first one's found in Deuteronomy 6. And that's kind of what I want to look at for just a second. This command to love God. Like, how do you command somebody to love? Have you ever thought about it that way? You know, it's like, how do you command to love somebody from somebody? You know, can we really look at our spouse and be like, love me? Love me. Like, can you do that? Well, not in the typical sense that our culture, that our society uses the word love, right? I use the word love to be like, I love pizza. You know, I mean, I wouldn't go that far with it, actually. That's not a good personal example. I really like pizza, really a lot, but I wouldn't say I love it. You know what I mean? But now, like, I love, I'm going to use it the way that culture uses it, I love peanut butter. Whew. Man, I really do. I enjoy peanut butter. What am I saying? I have a strong affection for it. I have a strong like. I get pleasure from it. I enjoy it. So can you command somebody to love something or someone? Well, not in that sense. So when Jesus is saying you need to love God, you need to love your neighbor, it's deeper than just a bit of an affection thing. It's an action thing. But we'll find that over time, our actions actually will come to have an effect on our affections in the end. When I first started drinking coffee, I'd occasionally put cream, maybe sugar, some different things in it. And I was mostly drinking it, again, just for the kind of the caffeine effect of it. But over time, I'm like, I want to acquire a taste for this. I want to just be able to drink coffee. And now, honestly, I don't drink anything but just straight black coffee, pretty strong coffee, and actually really enjoy it. But I kind of didn't at first. The more we do something, the stronger the connection in our mind becomes, and the more we may grow to really like something, to have a stronger affection. And so what we're going to see is that over time, as we do this, as we practice it, as we work something into our daily rhythms, our affection for it will grow. And so God commands that we love him with all of our heart, with our soul, with our mind, with our strength. And so it comes from Deuteronomy 6. Now in this passage here, I'm going to hit this and kind of wrap things up. This passage here, this is the second generation of Hebrews coming out of the Exodus from Egypt. The first generation murmured and complained against God. They were guilty of kind of hating on God, loving things, loving what they supposedly had back in Egypt more than they loved the God who just rescued them from slavery. And so God brings judgment on them. He says, hey, you're all going to die. Since you wanted to murmur and you wanted to complain and you wanted to gripe and you wanted to again, to kind of use modern language, throw some serious shade at me, he's like, you guys will never see the promised land. I'm not killing you right now, but you'll never see the promised land. You're going to wander in the desert, and not until every single one of you have died and your bodies have come to rest in this desert, in this wilderness, are any of my people going to enter into the promised land. And so here at the end of this time of wandering, when this second generation have all seen their parents or maybe grandparents pass away during this wilderness sojourn, Moses stands before them to give them some advice and some instructions from God. They stood on the edge of the promised land. They were getting ready to go in. They were going to conquer these wicked nations that God was bringing his judgment on. And so Moses tells them, and he kind of gives them a warning almost in some ways, because God had given him the wisdom to see what was going to happen to these Hebrews once they had tasted success and wealth. And so in Deuteronomy 6, we've designated as Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9, he says, listen, Israel. The Hebrew word there is Shema, Shema. And so, I guess in English, we might call it the Shema. And so this is actually kind of a creedal, foundational prayer that even modern Jews would actually pray. It's called the Shema. And it says that word, listen, Israel, the listen there, that Shema, it's more than that. It's actually more like a listen and do. Listen and obey. Hear and do. Hear this and then do it, Israel. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. You came out of a land where they worshiped a bunch of gods, and I systematically destroyed them with the plagues and brought you out and rescued you. I am one. There's only one of me. There's only one God that you worship. And that God, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And so this is where Jesus pulls us from, Deuteronomy 6. But then Moses goes on. And Moses kind of tells, I think this is the big solution for us. This is kind of how we work it into our lives. He says, these words that I'm giving you today are to be in your heart. When you get something in your heart, it doesn't leave. It's there. It's with you everywhere you go in every part of your day. Repeat them to your children, he says. Talk about them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Bind them as a sign on your hand and let them be a symbol on your forehead. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your city gates. He says, don't let these words depart from your mouth. Don't let these words ever get away from your heart. And so as a couple writers, Reggie Joyner and Kerry Newhoff, as they put it, his statement, Moses's, his statement transcends every generation. It taps into the potential of families across a variety of cultures. In some ways, what he said about the role of the family may have more meaning to us today than it did to the Hebrew people then. I'm sure some of the parents in that crowd thought, isn't that what we have been doing? How can you go through what we went through and not talk about it? You see, they had been in the wilderness. They had seen the miracles. They literally had a cloud of smoke by day that would lead them, that they would follow. They had a pillar of fire by night to provide protection and light. They didn't even go find their own food. Every day they would go outside their tents and manna. This in some translations says it looks like coriander seed. They would collect this stuff every morning and make food with it. And it came from heaven. It was provided by God. He says, we've already been doing this, right? I can imagine. I'm somebody, I don't like redundancy a lot of times. I don't like to be told something I already know. And I might have been standing there in the crowd, been guilty of this, looking at Moses, being like, Moses, duh. We already do that, bro. Like, why are you telling us to keep doing something that we already do every day? But Moses knew something. And so to go back to Joyner and Newhoff here, they say, but things were about to change. They were moving into the promised land. And if we're honest about our situations, most of us in the West would have to admit that we're pretty much living in a promised land of our own. Few of us have to wander outside our tents each morning and see if the manna has come once again. We have more than almost any other generation in history. And so they go on to say that some share the same anxiety Moses had about Canaan. That God will somehow be forgotten. Eternal truths will be diluted. The faith of a generation will die. In some ways, isn't that what's at stake? Isn't that what's happening? And so we see that God, through Moses, baked a solution right into the very fabric of our existence as humans. We all live and eat somewhere. We all travel somewhere. We all lie down to sleep and rise up to start all over again each day. And so he says, don't let these things depart from your mouth. He says, put them, right? Bind them on your wrists. Put them on the doorposts of your house, on your city gates. He says, talk about them. Have these conversations. Talk about me. Pursue me. In your meals with your kids. Pursue me as you're driving to work. Pursue me when you wake up in the morning and when you go to sleep at night. He says, I will be the conductor of these rhythms of your life by requiring you to include me into every bit of it in your very heart. And so I think that is a solution to not be guilty of again, to use Jesus's kind of words, of hating God, meaning to loving God less than the things of this world. The solution is to pray that our affections would be changed. That's the beauty of the gospel. It's not that we get saved and somehow just our actions are simply going to be different, but that over time, we are sanctified and purified in our very hearts by the Spirit of God Himself, that our affections change, that we love Jesus, that we love God and the things of God more than sinful things. That's the only way to root out bad behaviors, is to replace them with something that you love more. That's the only way to change an affection for one thing, is to root it out with a greater love. And so he says, in the very rhythm of your life, be intentional. In the very rhythm of your life, we need to work that in there. And so, you know, what does that look like? What does that look like on a day-to-day thing? Well, it means spending time in the scriptures, quality time, actually trying to understand the heart of God. When we understand him, we're going to pursue him more. When we really catch a glimpse of who God is, not only are we going to love him in action, but we're going to fall in love with him. And talk about him. If you have kids, talk about him with your kids. Don't make God just part of a Sunday rhythm. Make God a part of a daily rhythm with your family. Make it natural. Talk about what's going on with your kids and with their lives. And tie in biblical principles. Tie in gospel strands into your conversations with your kids. And as Jesus, you know, put it, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Love those around you, because here's the deal. You can't love God and mistreat the people he created. And as we do this, I think we're no longer going to be guilty of hating God. We're going to come and we're going to grow to a place where we love God above everything else in this world. And we're not going to let our love for family hold us back from following him and serving him. We're not going to let love for friendships hold us back from following him and serving him. We're definitely not going to let our love of sinful pleasures hold us back from following him and pursuing him and serving him. And ultimately, fulfilling our purpose by bringing him glory. So guys, I hope you've enjoyed today's video. Like I said, man, it's been different. I really wish I had Caleb here with me to discuss these things and we could talk about it and kind of given so many more personal examples. But I appreciate you if you stuck with me to the end. Guys, I want to encourage you, Crosswalk Podcast. We're on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, all those things, any major podcast streaming platform, we're there. It would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and a rating on there and reach out to us. Let us know, crosswalk.faith@gmail.com. Reach out to us. Let us know what you'd like to hear. And so, guys, until next time, this has been the Crosswalk Podcast, where real faith meets real life.